building have, certainly, we're listing all the passages that are important to building a full-orbed, robust understanding of the end-time drama, but I think some of the central ones, some of the most basic. And so, Daniel 2 and 7, like I say, by the time you get to Daniel, Daniel's living 600 years before Christ. Oops. So, but Daniel is late in the Old Testament, but by reason of the role that Daniel plays in destroying the doctrine of imminency, if you don't mind, and making it clear that there's going to be a succession of four empires before Messiah comes, it's at this point that you really begin to have the end-time drama laid out. And time out real quickly. One of the functions, I think even the book of Revelation, one of the, I think, functions of these very, very detailed descriptions of an end-time drama is to give us confidence it's going to happen. In other words, there's so much detail, it takes upon itself a reasonableness, a reality, and so on. Well, that's what's going on here. Let me take you to Daniel chapter 9. Now, this is the very famous prophecy of 70 weeks. Let's work our way through it very quickly. I know there's a lot of detail here, and if this is brand new to you, it will be a little difficult, but I just want to pick out a couple of central things. Remember what's going on here. Daniel knows from the book of Jeremiah, if you look in Daniel 9 and verse 1, he says that in the first year of Darius, and that would be 538, Daniel was carried off to captivity in 606. So do the arithmetic for me. If he was carried off in 606, and Jeremiah told him that there were going, the next verse says, in the first year, I understood by the book the number of the years specified by the word of the Lord through Jeremiah. Now in Jeremiah 25:10 and 27:11, I think those are the two verses, God twice says, all right, time out, Jeremiah is an early contemporary to Daniel. In other words, their lives overlap, but Jeremiah lived earlier, and he lived back there in Judah, and he prophesied that Babylon was the rod of God's anger and was going to destroy Judah, Israel. But he two different times he said that Israel would be carried off to Babylon for 70 years. So Daniel's reading this. He can do arithmetic. He was carried off in 606. So he says, all right, 606, now it's 538. He's not using BC dating, obviously. But my point is, he can do the arithmetic, and he has been in captivity, what, about 68 years. So he realizes that those 70 years are about up. And he's hungry to know what God has for the future, and so he begins to pray. And he prays a prayer of confession. But then if you jump way down to chapter, to the same chapter to be sure, and verse 20, it says, while I was speaking, praying, confessing my sin, verse 21, while I was speaking, the man Gabriel, whom I had seen at the beginning, Daniel chapter 7, being caused to fly swiftly, came, and he said, Daniel, I've come to answer your prayer. So Gabriel comes directly from the throne of God, and he says, I was talking to Brian earlier, it's interesting, you look at verse 23, he says, at the beginning of your supplications, the command went out, and I have come to tell you. So, you wonder, you can almost figure out how fast an angel can fly, or you can almost figure out how far he had to come. I mean, if you start, and somebody has done this in Hebrew, just read from the beginning of the prayer, and it takes about 2 minutes to read. So, if he started out at the beginning of the prayer, and he shows up in verse 20, right? You know, I've really been trucking, and I got here as quick as I could. So, if D equals R times T, right? Distance equals rate times time. We could kind of come up with the time. If we could come up with the rate, we could figure out how fast an angel can go. If we could figure the distance, we could figure the rate. Never mind. The point is, by the way, angels are created beings. They're not little gods. They can only be in one place at one time, and it takes a little time to get from one place to the other, right here. But more substantively, here is the prophecy. From Daniel 9, 24 to 27, you have probably, look, let me just tell you this. The reason it's imperative that we spend time is, The whole chronology of the end times is the drama is built on Daniel 9. This is hugely seminal, if you know that word. It's the seed out of which everything else grows. So our concept of of the end times is really dependent on this. So what does he say? He simply says, 70 weeks. All right, now let's stop on this. I'm gonna be very quick, but so if I excite questions, stop me. But I need to say it. The weeks here are clearly weeks of years. Do you have weeks in your translation? Some will put sevens, because the Hebrew word is, in fact, sevens. 70 sevens. But it's clearly a portion of time, and we don't think of our lives being lived out in cycles of 7 years. So it doesn't, weeks of years, that doesn't make sense to us. We live in decades, but not weeks, right? Did the Jewish people live in weeks of years? What was every seventh year? It was the Sabbath year. The land was to lie fallow. Debts were suspended. Slaves were to go a year without having to pay their debt, indentured slaves. So clearly, Israel's life was lived out in cycles of 7 years. So for him to say, furthermore, here's an interesting thing, they are in Babylon for 70 years. How did God arrive at that number, do you recall? They had neglected the Sabbath year for 500 years. And so God says, I'm going to get my Sabbath years back. So the whole experience down here in Babylon is sort of a function of this idea of cycles of 7 years. So when God says, Gabriel says, 70 cycles of 7 years, that's 490 years, he says, are fixed upon you, your people, and your holy city. And he says, to finish the transgression, make an end of sins. I'm not going to read that. The point is to bring in the kingdom, to get us to the time when the kingdom of righteousness is here. But then he says this, verse 25, know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, now watch this, shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. All right, now it's not as hard as it sounds. What he says is, from the going forth of a certain command, that command was issued by Artaxerxes to Nehemiah in 444 BC. Now, Daniel is receiving this vision, or actually it's not so much a vision, it's just this message directly from the lips of Gabriel, in 538, the first year of Darius. But Gabriel tells him that the clock will start ticking when the decree goes forth. That decree was issued on Nisan 1, Nisan being a month of the year in the spring, on Nisan 1, 444 BC. Got that? He says, from the going forth of a decree to rebuild and restore and rebuild Jerusalem, on to Messiah the Prince will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. So how many weeks is that? 69. Why the 7 and the 62 is really a little tough, but it probably has to do with the fact that it took Nehemiah about 50 years to really get Jerusalem reinstated. So when Nehemiah, again, the decree goes to Nehemiah, this is Nehemiah 1, to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. There's a cycle of 7 weeks and 62. They're hard upon one another. So it's a total of 69 weeks. That's 483 years. Got that? So from the beginning, from the going forth of the commandment on to Messiah the Prince will be 483 years. Now, I'm going to stop on that real quickly. This is a different subject, but it's rather fascinating. If you do your homework, you will discover that these years are actually, see, the question arises, how long is a year? Now, you think of the year as 365 and a quarter days. These were not primitive, uninformed people, but they didn't live by the kind of calendar we live by. They lived by a lunar calendar. And so would you in that day, because you had this beautiful timepiece that went through this 29 and three-quarter day cycle, and so everybody lived by the moon. The problem is that there are not an even number of lunar cycles in one annual solar cycle. In other words, there are not an even number of lunar months in a year. Does that make sense to you? And the time it takes the Earth to do an entire cycle is not even with the time it takes the moon to make 12 cycles. And so every, I think it's seven times every 19 years, the Jews inserted an extra month. Now, that sounds horribly complicated. It really wasn't as bad as it sounds. But suffice it to say that their months were not all the same length. The years, the months were always the same length. But their years weren't. Does that make sense to you? Have I confused you horribly? It works out nicely. See, the thing about it is, the Jews have these three feasts every year. And those feasts are on a certain day of a certain month. But the problem is, those feasts are all connected to a harvest. So if you have the feast of Passover, which is in connection with, the feast of Passover, at the same time you keep the feast of first fruits, which has to be happened when the first fruits of the harvest are coming in, and the harvest isn't ready, you got to wait. That makes sense to you? It all works out perfectly. But they, every, like I said, I'm quite sure the figure is seven times every 19 years. But, so when God made a long-term prophecy that it wanted to be down to the very day, it was difficult because there wasn't a standard length of the year. So what you discover, and you do this exegetically, there's really no question about it, when God makes these long-term prophecies, he's talking about 360-day years. And it works out fine, but they're even years. And so, I'll come back to that in a minute. Let me just say this. What Daniel is told here is that from a going forth of a commandment, that was Nisan 1, 444 B.C., on to Messiah the Prince, would be exactly 483 years of 360 days each. Exegetically, you can come to that conclusion. Here's an interesting thing. If you take your perpetual calendar and start on a Nisan 1444 and count forward exactly that much times, 173,880 days, you count forward that number of days, guess where you come out? I'm going to say March 29th. But, yeah, I know what you're thinking of. But it's a little vaguely calendar. Are you getting it from Sir Robert Anderson and Al McLean? Harold Honer, I got to tell you, bro, I'm proud. I'm impressed, but Harold Honer, in his book Chronological Aspects of the Life of Christ, deals with that, and he just corrects it in a couple of places, and it comes out to March 29, 33 AD. But the big thing is, that's what? What happened on that day?
That's what he wrote.
That's the triumphal entry. If you start out on that day, Nisan 1, and count forward that number of days, you come out square on the day when Jesus rode into the city of Jerusalem. Now, what does the prophecy say? From the going forth of the commandment on to Messiah the Prince, the one moment when Jesus most dramatically and formally offered himself to Israel as her Messiah was the triumphal entry. That's what that whole day is all about. They were taught in Psalm 118. Psalm 118 is a messianic psalm. It's the psalm of messianic inauguration. It's where God teaches you how to receive Messiah when he appears. And you are taught to cry out, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." You know what else? Here, this is a verse in that. Every one of you knows by heart a verse in Psalm 118. I think it's verse 23. I'll start it, you finish it. "This is the day which the Lord has made." Now, we take that verse and we apply it to this day or the other day. Help yourself. But that's not what the psalmist is talking about. He's talking about one day, and it's the day of Messiah's appearance, and only God could send the Messiah. This is a fulfillment of Genesis 3:15. This is the day which the Lord has made. And it's interesting that you have Daniel saying, from the going forth of that commandment unto Messiah the Prince, and you count forward that many days, and on that day Jesus rides into the city. And he tells, remember when his enemies come and say, "Make your disciples stop," Jesus says, if they don't cry out, the very stones will cry out. Why? Because this is the day which the Lord has made. It's imperative that we cry, that we rejoice. And by the way, you are to recognize him by crying out, this is Psalm 118, verse 25, "Save now." Can you say that in Hebrew? Hoshana, that's exactly right. So Hosanna, which is what they're crying. That's not just an empty praise word. It means save now, be our Savior. So it's interesting, when Jesus left the city of Jerusalem in Matthew 23, on that day, the day of the triumphal entry, no, Luke tells us this, that Luke 19, that he looked on the city and he said, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, if only you had known what belonged to you on this thy day." So Daniel says, no, Gabriel says, from the going forth of the commandment on to Messiah the Prince would be 69 sevens. So how many sevens we got left?
One,
right? 70 sevens are fixed upon you to bring in the kingdom. Now, beginning from the commandment to restore the Jerusalem will be 69. That'll unto Messiah the Prince. But go back to the text. Notice what he says. Then, and the Hebrew is quite explicit here. Then he says, until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks, 62 weeks. Streets will be built. By the end of the verse, the streets will be built again, even in troublesome time. That's a reference to Nehemiah's efforts in those first 7 weeks. But then, notice verse 7, verse 26. After the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. What's that? It's crucifixion. And, now this is where you got to pay attention. The people of the prince who is to come. Remember what Daniel learned in Daniel chapter 7? What's burning in his mind? Is that little horn. Remember that? Which beast did that little horn come out of? The fourth. What's that? That's Rome. The Antichrist. It's Antichrist. But the beast out of which he comes is Rome. So it doesn't say the prince will destroy the city. It says the people of the prince. That's Rome. What happened in AD 70? Rome destroyed the city and the temple, Titus Vespasian. So, what Daniel is told is that there will be 69 weeks until the official appearance of Messiah. But after the 69 weeks, there are two events. Those 69 weeks ended on Sunday in the triumphal entry. That next week, I believe on Friday, we can debate about that another time, but that next week, Jesus was crucified. That's the first of those events. And then some 37 years later, Rome destroyed Jerusalem. So then it says, all right, so I'm going to go back. After the 62 weeks, all right, time out now. Remember, it was 7 and 62. They're together. But in the context, he's saying you have that, the 7 and the 62, that total 69, but after that block of 62 weeks, which means after the 69, you're going to have these two events. Messiah will be cut off, and the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and so on. And then it says, verse 27, then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. Now, two things in that verse. Notice them carefully. Notice, number one, that there is a gap between the 69th and 70th week. And we're not making it up. Exegetically, there's a gap, right? You have the 69. After the 69, you have two events. Then, the Hebrew is explicit, then he'll confirm the covenant. So the 70th week, there are, in fact, 70 weeks fixed upon your people. But there's a gap. We have no idea how long that gap is. You and I live in that gap. You understand that? Because then it says in verse 27, then he shall confirm. Now the huge issue here is, who is he? Is it Messiah? Or is it the prince who shall come? I'm not going to build the case. I think we can do it exegetically. But theologically, it won't work to do any other. The one who confirms the covenant with many, and the many there is often in the Old Testament reference to Israel, for 1 week, is in fact the little horn, the prince who shall come. So the little horn, the Antichrist, is going to confirm a covenant, and when that covenant is confirmed, the 70th week begins. The 70th week is 7 years. This is why we sometimes call about Daniel's 70th week. The 70th week is a 70th period of 7 years. Those 7 years are what we're going to be. Now, this is early. This is the first time we're introduced to this, and we're going to learn a lot more about this. All of Revelation 6 to 19 is about this. But this is the very first time we're introduced to this simple reality that before the kingdom is established, there will be a 70th week, a 70th course of 7 years, and during that time, that time will be dominated by this little horn, this prince who's going to confirm the covenant. Now, interestingly enough, we're not told the substance of that covenant. What is this covenant that he makes with Israel? But notice what it says. He shall confirm the covenant of the week, but in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering on the wings of abomination, which shall make desolate. So in the middle of the week, he violates the covenant, and when he does, he brings an end to sacrifice and oblation. It seems pretty reasonable to deduce that if breaking the covenant means bringing an end to sacrifice and oblation, then what does the covenant have to do with? Making it possible. So it's out of this verse exclusively that I don't think it's a deduction. Well, it's kind of a half-step deduction, but I think it's pretty plain that the Antichrist, this little horn, remember we got introduced to him with Daniel 7, and in Daniel's ear, he couldn't sleep for some time as he thought about that little horn. He tells us that in Daniel 7. Now, we're taking the next step. This is progressive violation. And we're told that there are 70 weeks that are fixed in order to bring in the kingdom, but there will be a cycle of 69 weeks, and in that 69 weeks, Messiah will appear, but then after the 69A, Messiah will be cut off, but not from self, and then the city will be destroyed. That happens in 70 AD. And after those events, we don't know how long, so far it's been a couple of years, after those events, there will be a 70th week, and that 70th week will begin with Antichrist making some sort of a treaty with the Jewish people. And quite clearly, the substance of that treaty has to do with allowing them to restore their temple sacrifices. But in the middle of the week, he high-handedly breaks the covenant, causes sacrifices and oblations to cease, and wreaks horrible abomination upon the people. That make sense to you? Now, you're already filling in a lot of blanks from what you know in Revelation, but at this point, this is all Daniel knows. This is progressive revelation. All we know is, from Daniel 2 and 7, this is the four kingdoms, and in those four kingdoms, Messiah will appear, but there will be this opponent, this evil villain, this little one. We already know that from Daniel 7, right? Now in Daniel 9, we're given a little more information. We're given a basic chronology, 69 weeks to Messiah, and then a couple of events, and then a 70th week. So we're living in that gap of time, and we're waiting for that 70th week. That make sense to you? Any questions about that? Folks, let me tell you something. This is a little extra. I believe Jesus is coming soon. I'm not a date setter. I think it's dangerous to set dates. I think speculation is God-honoring. Help yourself. You just admit that it's speculation. You know, you may be putting two and two together and coming up with 22, but if it turns out you are, do it again, as far as I'm concerned. You know, honest to goodness. But, you know what I'm saying? I'm saying, yeah, I just think it's remarkable. But the curious thing, I'm going to beat up on him. The amillennialist doesn't believe in any sign of the times. There's no sense in which God is setting, because they don't believe in an end-time drama. You and I believe in end-time drama that's going to happen on this earth. So we're looking at the earth and we're saying, man, the props are all in place. I don't know when the curtain's going up, but man, the props are really in place. They're saying, there's no end-time drama. So what's happening is really meaningless. We're, you know, all we know is we're closer to today than we were before, but we don't know when it's going to happen. It's going to be a general resurrection. We're all going to heaven, and that's all there will be, and there's nothing to happen on this earth, so they're not interested. But I look at the world, and there are many ways, and we can share these things in many ways. But one of the things that really strikes me, because I spend a lot of time, every chance I get, I'm in Israel. And in Israel, there is a passion that is growing exponentially among the Jews to restore their temple worship. And it has not always been so. See, historically, here's an interesting thing. Historically, you basically had two sorts of Jews. You had atheistic, secular Jews, and that's the great preponderance of them, and they don't believe in Messiah, they don't believe in anything, they don't want anything to do with it, but they know, all right, I got to make sure you understand, there is a Temple Mount. It is the place where David brought the threshing floor of Arabah, where he brought the tabernacle up, where Solomon built first of all, it was the place where Abraham offered up Isaac. But then on that same, exact same spot, the temple was built, the tabernacle was first, well, it was the temple was built, tabernacle was portable for a time, but then David bought this plot and Solomon built that tabernacle, temple, and we can identify, and I'd love to talk to you about it, but I haven't had time, but we can identify the spot. It's under a thing called today the Dome of the Rock. Can I just tell you something, too? When you go to Israel, there are a lot of places to have your picture taken. Don't take it in front of the Dome of the Rock. I could see people with all these group pictures of the Dome of the Rock. That is a pimple on the face of the earth. That is one of the most hideous, most thoroughly God-dishonoring structures on the face of the earth. I can't overstate how wicked that dome is. It is built on the rock where the temple was. By the way, inside that Islam structure are Arabic words. You know what they say? On the inside of that dome, there is one God. His name is Allah, and he has no son. And it is as deliberately a God-defying, God of the Bible-defying structure as anywhere on the earth. But the point is, that's the only place in the world where the Jews will even think about building their temple, right where that dome is. And that dome is the third most precious place in all of Islam. Don't get me started. But the point is that historically, the secular atheistic Jews have said, listen, that's the fuse. And it is to the Third World War. You don't want it, you can have it. You know, when the Jews captured Jerusalem in that remarkable war, Six-Day War, 1967, Moshe Dayan, on the fly, made a decision to leave the Temple Mount in the hands of the Muslim authorities. And they've honored that ever since. So that place, there are two holy places up there, the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock, and it is sacred out of pure spite to the Muslims. Look, do you know how many times the word Jerusalem is in the Hebrew Bible? I can't remember exactly. Around 700. You know how many times the word Jerusalem is in the Quran? Zero. He never went to... It's the only reason Jerusalem is sacred to the Muslims is because they hate the Jews. And they want to take it from the Jews. So you have this... My point is that you have these secular Jews. They don't want anything to do with it. Then you have the Orthodox Jews. Now, this is an important thing. Zechariah says specifically that when Messiah comes, he will build the temple. It says it three times. He will build the temple. He will build the temple. So the Orthodox Jews have always said, it's not our job to build the temple. So we're not interested in doing it. And we're waiting on Messiah to see when he'll do it. But about 30 years ago, there was a group called the Temple Institute. And their teacher began to insist that, to be sure, Messiah must build the temple. But what he's waiting for is a show of desire and faith on the part of the Jewish people. So if they would simply make ready for the temple, then Messiah would appear. And as a matter of fact, if they would lay the foundation, and about 20-some years ago, they actually formed a big foundation stone, and they actually made application to the government authorities there in Jerusalem to ask them to take that up in the Temple Mount. Of course, they told them, you know, fat chance, you know, you try it. But sure enough, on a certain day, they hauled it out and started down the street, and it was a big riot, and 18 people were killed, you know, and the police made them put it back in a warehouse. Now, every year, they get it out, and they make a little motion, so... So the point is that there's this group who insist if we can just lay the foundation stone, that God will respond by sending Messiah. And so they are doing everything they can. And you can go to Israel today. There's another group called the Temple Faithful, and they're a little more public about it, but they're the same thing. And they have a shop. And you can go to their shop, and they'll show you all the utensils they made. They just fashioned the menorah, the big 7 golden candlestick. You know, they've got that fashioned now. And they're training young men. If your name is Cohen or Khan or Levi, they'll pay your way to go to school to train. Because they believe that Messiah, they're hungry. Now, my point is, all throughout the narrative that we're describing here, and I need to get back to, all throughout the narrative, central to it is an apostate third temple. The Jews have had two temples. The first was built by Solomon, destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. The second was built by Zerubbabel and destroyed by Titus Vespasian in 70 AD. They are looking for a third temple. You and I are looking for a fourth temple. Because there will be a temple in the millennium. But the temple there was, as a matter of fact, I would say that you can buy, it's one of the nice souvenir shops in Jerusalem, in the Jewish quarter there, is this temple faithful. You can buy really nice stuff in there. But there's a plaque there that says all proceeds go toward fashioning, you know, articles for the soon-coming Messianic temple. And that's an apostate temple. I don't buy anything in there because I don't want any more plaques in the Antichrist temple that says, you know, Doug Bookman's, you know, dude. So I won't buy but I'm looking for a fourth temple. But I'm saying to you that, I go way back to it, you read that in Daniel 9, and central to the end time drama is this apostate temple, and that temple is built under the direct auspices of the Antichrist. That's what it says. He'll confirm a covenant, and evidently by reason of that covenant, they'll be able to restore their worship. Because when he breaks the covenant, their worship is broken off, and even his worship of himself. And so it is so interesting to me in terms of this issue of the nearness of Jesus coming that all of a sudden in human history, this is something rather new, the last 20, 25 years, there is a huge segment of Jewish thinkers who are convinced that soon their worship will be restored. And they're hungry to do it, and they're making ready to build the temple. All they need is some sort of a world-class diplomat who is able to, in a stroke of some sort of diplomatic genius, who is able to gain permission. Does that make sense to you? There's a lot more I could tell you. But any questions about our outline statement? It's a bit. So, yeah.
I'm just confused about, again, the third and the fourth temple.
The third temple, that's a very good point. I made reference to it. The third temple is built under the auspices of Antichrist, but then it's wiped clean at the second coming.
Right.
And then in the millennium, clearly there's a temple, and Jesus reigns from that temple. Now, as you read about that temple in Ezekiel 40 to 48, there's evidently a reworking of the topography of that part of the world, because it's, what, 50 miles across and so on. There's not even enough room, so there seems to be a restructuring of that part of the earth in order to accommodate this glorious temple from which Messiah will reign. And it's laid out carefully. I mean, you look at a good study Bible, and it'll have charts and diagrams of that millennial temple and so on, and where that's the fourth. The third is Antichrist's. So you got Solomon's destroyed. You got Zerubbabel's that was destroyed. There's one yet to come during the tribulation.
I mean, the temple, the third temple, is what the Jews are trying to reconstruct. That,
well, yes, yes. They are clearly. That's such a good point. They're trying to build it in unbelief. I mean, they're rejecting Messiah. Here's an interesting thing. At least, I guess you've got to decide at this late hour, but of all the Christian claims that drive unbelieving Jews nuts, really, the one Christian claim that angers the Jews, unbelieving Jews above all others, more than the claim that Jesus is the only way, more than the claim that Jesus is God, more than the claim that Jesus resurrected, the one that every thinking unbelieving Jew will be angry at you for is the claim that the Mosaic Covenant was temporary. But that law system with its sacrifices was only anticipatory. And in defiance of that, they want to rebuild that and reinstitute those Old Testament sacrifices. Now, we believe in a fourth temple where there will be sacrifices, but there will be millennial sacrifices, and they'll be built around that old temple. It'll be the dwelling place and the seat of rule for a returned Jesus Messiah, you know. But they're looking to build a third temple, which is a high-handed act of defiance against the claim that Jesus was the end of the law for righteousness. They're going to reinstitute those sacrifices. And it's a high-handed exercise in defiant disbelief. It's not just a cultural thing. That dynamic is huge. Okay, what do we know? Four kingdoms. Last days of the fourth kingdom, Messiah will come. There'll be trouble. He'll be opposed by this awful end-time personage, the little horn. Daniel 9 is actually a timetable. 70 weeks, about 69 on the Messiah, then a gap of time. We don't know how long that is. We're living in it now. Then there's a 70th week. So the issue is not so much time, it's events. There's going to be 69 weeks on to the coming of Messiah, then two events, the cutting off of Messiah and the destruction of the temple, and then a 70th week. We're waiting for that 70th week. But this is what we know. This is what we know. Remember, wherever you are, bring everything God already said with you. When Jesus comes, and begins to speak of himself as Messiah and offer the kingdom to his generation, he can't mean, if you take me to, as Messiah today, you can have the kingdom tomorrow. That can't be, because we already know there's got to be a 70th week. Right? That's already fixed. So we know that there's a cycle. We don't know much about that. Now, we're going to learn more before Jesus. We're going to learn more in the Old Testament. Jesus is going to talk a lot about this in his outer discourse. But we know that the end-time drama includes a 70th cycle of 7 years, which will begin with the Jews, evidently, under the auspices of the Antichrist, being able to reestablish their sacrifices. In the middle, that'll be broken. And notice what he says. I should emphasize this more carefully. Jesus concludes by saying, after he ends breaks the covenant, the last part of verse 27, on the ring of abomination shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation which is determined to pour out the desolate. Now, that sounds a little confusing, but what it means is there will be unspeakable destruction that will render the world desolate until the final consummation when one comes to clean it up. And so, we already know the 70th week, right? See, it's so often that people, you know, read, for instance, the Gospels, and they read it as if we're starting from scratch. We don't know anything yet. Yeah, we do. We already know that there is a 70th week, and it's fixed. It's a given now. There has to be that 70th week. Does that make sense to you? All right, let's take another break here. Go ahead. Is it dinner time? I can't remember when we're going
to
eat.
Yeah. Just a question that came in mind about this offering sacrifice. It doesn't say anything about temple. It just says offering sacrifices. And I'm thinking back to when Ezra and Nehemiah and Zerubbabel went back to the land. The first thing they did was build the bronze altar with no temple or anything, and they were offering sacrifices before the temple.
Well, not quite. Actually, they laid the foundation of the temple. What they had to do was scrape off, and everything had to be in a certain place. And here's the thing. The sacrifices, understand that what's at stake here is this, and this is so important to the system. The temple is the place where God dwells. Now, interestingly enough, and this is a big question, but in the second temple, remember Solomon built that huge, beautiful first temple that people came from across the world to look at, Queen Sheba? The second temple was a disappointment in every way. It was small, it was squatty, it was an unwalled city. I love that verse in Ezra chapter 3 where it says that when they did that, when they scraped away the rubble and laid out the foundation and then built the altar, they said, well, let's go ahead. And there were some men who were young and had been brought up in Babylon and had never been able to honor Leviticus and offer sacrifices. And when they began to offer sacrifices, they wept for joy. But the verse says that there were some men who were old, there were white hairs, it calls them. And they lived during the days of Solomon. And they remembered that glorious temple. When they saw this squatty little affair, they too began to weep. And Ezra 3 says, you couldn't tell who was weeping for joy and who was weeping for sorrow. That's the whole restoration period. You know, so much to be excited about, so much to be disappointed in. But the primary thing to be disappointed in about this second temple is there was no glory cloud and there was no Ark of the Covenant. The inner chamber, the Holy of Holies, was empty. Now, I spent a lot of time, I can go to Zechariah and show you how God covered that, but the fact of the matter is that there was much about this second temple that needs to be disappointed, but the basic idea is God has once again allowed us to approach Him, and the means by which you approach Him is sacrifice. And so I think their point is that early on in this whole process, because they're trying to rebuild, they're doing this in the presence of God, and so they're going to, as soon as they can, to begin to offer sacrifices, to purify themselves, and to enable themselves with clean conscience, as it were, to do this work in these sacred precincts and so on. But as soon as they can, they get it up, and they get up the temple, and to be sure, the rabbis say that there were five things missing from the second temple, and two of them were the glory cloud and the Ark of the Covenant. But it always makes me wonder what happened on the Day of Atonement. And, you know, I guess he just sprinkled it on the ground. I mean, normally he would go in and take the blood and sprinkle on the lid. Remember the lid of the Ark of the Covenant? Here's God, here's the broken law, and here's the Ark, and that's what's that lid called, remember? That's the mercy seat. You know the New Testament word for mercy seat? Propitiation, that's right. And he is our propitiation. He's our mercy seat. And the blood is sprinkled between God and the broken law. And the second temple was an empty room. I mean, it really is staggering. But having said that, I think that basic idea that we, this is God's dwelling place, and in some special sense he has sanctified this, and if we're going to even approach him, approach this place, we need to purify ourselves, and that's done by sacrifice. So I think it's central to it. But the Jews today long for sacrifice, but they think of it as a ritualistic, formalistic way to please God. You know, I mean, it's that empty... Clearly, they don't understand what God was trying to communicate, or they would embrace Messiah. So it's an unbelieving exercise, although it will appear, I think, in a believing setting in the millennium, but that's another thing. All right, are we going to... Go ahead. Yeah.
I just had one comment about Jerusalem and the temple and such, and back in 1 Kings, we read that it says here, this is when the temple or the kingdom was to be ripped from Solomon's hands. He says, but to his son I will give one tribe, that my servant David may be a lamp always before me in Jerusalem, the city where I have chosen for myself to put my name.
Listen to that.
That's why Islam wants.
Exactly.
Not
yeah.
Only
well said.
Jerusalem, and Satan wants it the most.
Yeah.
And that's why it's the way it is. I mean, the battle's on right now. They've got half the city now. And they want it all.
And you'll never understand what's going on there if you don't bring that spiritual dynamic to it. Thank you. That is so good. And it's that concept. Is Jerusalem any more special than any other place in the face of the earth? No, except for this. God decided to put his name there. And there's only one city, one spot. I can take you there. You can stand there. It's the spot where God determined to put his name. And for that reason, it is. And it is so fascinating to trace the way all through human history, to this day, that's the center of the universe. That's what everybody is worried about. That is the cup of trembling that keeps the world nervous every single generation after the next. And it's all because God put his name there, and this is a world that hates that God, and they're going to do everything they can to wipe it out. Yeah, that's well said. That's a good point. Okay.